Nuclear cleanup versus nuclear extraction for profit. Which is it? One is about health and safety, while the other is about corporate profit at the expense of people and the environment. And that's the situation being faced on Navajo Nation, where, once again, the government is attempting to force through a scheme not in the best interest of the people. They're pushing to take radioactive waste from abandoned uranium mines and put it through a questionable process to extract marketable uranium while leaving behind even more unremediated radioactive uranium waste and contaminated water. And what's worse is that while the people of Navajo Nation may be against a project that exposes them to ongoing contamination with dangers disguised as a cleanup, the Navajo Nation Environmental Protection Agency is supporting and promoting this remediation con job. It takes a veteran Navajo Nation activist to see through the false messaging and to explain the long-range impact and implications of this scheme if it goes through. And she tells us,
I've worked for Navajo EPA for 4 years in the past, so I understand how they're maneuvering and not letting the people part of this conversation, because the questions are going to come up. And because they have no answers, they're saying it's a study, they don't know. And so it's just too much risk for the Navajo people to carry that burden again. The company will have no liability if there's something that goes wrong, if there's an accident, if workers get sick. The company is not liable. The Navajo Nation will be.
And there's a lot more that's wrong with this too. Well, when Anna Rondon, a dedicated lifetime advocate for the rights of Navajo and other indigenous people, warns you about the dangers hidden behind slick wording and government agency manipulation when it comes to abandoned, unremediated uranium mines, you might feel entitled to get really angry about how they and we are being pushed once again into that awful, dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear, who want to know something, and people who know something who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, two featured interviews. In the first, Anna Rondon, a veteran activist for Navajo Nation, explains the current push that calls itself a cleanup of abandoned uranium mines, but is really a scheme to extract commercially viable uranium to be sold for corporate profit, while the Navajo people get stuck with even more radioactive waste and other fallout. Then we hear from Kevin Camps, radioactive waste watchdog for Beyond Nuclear, on the drive to start the aged, previously shuttered Palisades nuclear reactor on Lake Michigan, despite known dangers and damage to the trouble-plagued reactor. We will also have nuclear news from around the world. Alistair Burnett of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons with the ICAN update, Jack Cohen-Joppa of the Nuke Resistor with another story from our shared history of activist resistance to nuclear weapons, and lots more honest and verified nuclear information. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, February 3rd, 2026, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting out this week with the ICAN update. A look back at issues from 2025, and a summary of where we are now, including the latest on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, or the TPNW. Reporting direct from the headquarters of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN, in Geneva, Switzerland, is ICAN's Alistair Burnett. It includes his interview with Florian Eblenkamp, ICAN's advocacy coordinator.
Hi, this is Alistair Burnett from ICAN in Geneva, with the latest from the campaign to abolish nuclear weapons. First of all, please accept the best wishes for the new year from all of us here at ICAN. The year got off to an unwelcome start, though, when President Trump decided to illegally attack Venezuela and abduct President Maduro. Although Mr. Maduro had a poor human rights record, the US undermined international law in its military operation against Venezuela, which was a clear violation of the UN Charter. The attack adds to the damage already done by Russia in its invasion of Ukraine, Israel in its war on Gaza, not to mention previous American actions like its invasion and occupation of Iraq. In early February, we're also facing a dangerous nuclear moment when the last remaining nuclear arms control treaty between the US and Russia, New START, expires on the 5th of February. President Putin has offered to agree to continue to abide by its terms for another year to give time to negotiate a replacement. But at time of recording, President Trump has not responded formally and seems to be content to let the treaty lapse. "If it expires, it expires," he recently told the New York Times. Given his previous talk about wanting denuclearization talks, it seems when push comes to shove, that isn't a priority for him. President Trump followed up on the Venezuelan attack with threats against Colombia, Mexico, and Cuba. But the most recent focus of attention outside of the United States has been his revival of threats to annex Greenland, an autonomous region of Denmark, which just happens to be a NATO ally. Trump has been trying to bully Denmark to cede the territory with military and economic threats. He has since retracted these, but still says he wants the territory. The crisis has convinced even the most pro-American European leaders that the US can no longer be trusted as an ally. But it's also reminded Europeans that the US military has bases all over Europe and Greenland and can do pretty much what it likes if it chooses to. It is still unclear how all this will play out, but it raises profound issues of trust that could open the way to the removal of American nuclear weapons from Europe, where 6 countries currently host them. After all, what's the point of hosting weapons that make you a nuclear target if the US can't be trusted to defend you? I spoke to my colleague, Florian Eblenkamp, who leads our advocacy with NATO countries, to hear more about how campaigners can use the current crisis to accelerate getting rid of these weapons.
If I were a European leader, I would ask myself the question, can I still trust Donald Trump that the nuclear weapons that are deployed in my country will not become bargaining chips for his loyalty? So I think nuclear deterrence in this context has always been not very credible. But now the trust between countries that these roles would actually be fulfilled is completely eradicated. And I think there's only one conclusion, that this concept is not fit for the purpose of keeping anyone safe and that these weapons must be removed before they become bargaining chips by the US.
What do you think European campaigners who want European countries to join the TPNW and to abolish nuclear weapons completely, what do you think they can do?
First of all, we have to show solidarity with those that are being bullied around. So in this case, the people in Greenland. Then we need to use this moment to highlight the very real danger that comes from the security arrangement where nuclear weapons are deployed to other countries. And of course, we should highlight the fact that this concept behind it, nuclear deterrence, is not something that we want our countries to rely on, because it's not something that will keep us safe if worse comes to worse. And therefore, let's work with parliamentarians, for example. Let's address the foreign ministers to demand that these weapons will be removed from the territories of our countries and that our security is built on something more credible that excludes weapons of mass destruction.
Of course, the Americans aren't the only country that has nuclear weapons deployed in European countries. Russia has also got nuclear weapons now deployed in Belarus since the beginning of the war in Ukraine. What can be done about them?
What can be done in Belarus, of course, is that Belarus gets pressured to return these weapons to Russia and that Russia gets pressured to remove these weapons from Belarus. Like the American nuclear weapons in Europe, the Russian nuclear weapons in Belarus have the only purpose of bombing Europe. So there's really no security advantage either for the Americans with their bombs in Europe, nor for the Russians with their nuclear weapons in Belarus. Therefore, all this does is escalate an already tense situation, and no one gains security from this.
That was Florian Eblenkamp, and this is Alistair Burnett, ending this news roundup for Nuclear Hot Seat.
Now here's this week's first featured interview. Navajo Nation continues to be a target for the nuclear industry, which has contaminated their land with hundreds of abandoned uranium mines, unremediated accident sites, and now a scheme to extract commercially viable uranium from mine tailings while contaminating precious water supplies and leaving behind even more radioactive waste. It's a money grab for extractive resources that will be sold to give foreign companies the profit, but leave the Navajo people with more waste, no cleanup, and all the responsibility. Fortunately for Navajo Nation, there are some fierce veteran activists who are pushing back to have their say in the matter, and we are honored to have one of them with us today. Anna Rondon is a dedicated lifetime advocate for the rights of Indigenous people. For the past 40 years, Anna has worked in various leadership positions, including for the Navajo Nation government, the Eastern Navajo Agency and Local Government Office, the Navajo Nation Chichilta Chapter, and the Navajo Nation Department of Health. She is currently with the New Mexico Social Justice Equity Institute. Note that in the interview, Anna uses the term CERCLA, which is commonly known as Superfund, the U.S. federal government program designed to fund the cleanup of toxic wastes. I spoke with Anna Rondon on January 31st, 2026. Anna Rondon, it is always great to have you here with us on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Yate, greetings, thank you.
There are more than 500 abandoned uranium mines on Navajo Nation. What, if anything, has been done to clean them up and remediate the land?
Well, since the 80s, there's been some topsoil covering of some abandoned uranium mines, like in Utah, Cameron, Arizona. There's been some cleanup, but what they've been doing is the past nearly 40 years is putting 18 inches of topsoil on top of the tailings. But throughout the years, we've seen erosion from the rain and also from the wind. And so those are still being exposed because of the deterioration in the integrity of the topsoil. Of course, it's going to erode, but it's still eroding and there's no continued maintenance. It's not cleanup. It's a limited amount of containment. It's containment, not cleanup.
And of course, that's temporary containment because 18 inches of topsoil is not very much and there's nothing holding it down.
Exactly.
Now there is a proposal, some might call it a scheme, for a company called DESA to use something called high pressure slurry ablation, HPSA. It's a system that they use and they're calling it a cleanup for the mines. What is the HPSA system and how accurate is it to call it a cleanup?
That's the question regarding this process that has proven in their study that they conducted on Navajo. And the study within their own report does say that it didn't meet the requirements. And so they're still trying to push and do a pilot project, which is phase two of this HPSA, high pressure slurry ablation process. It works on other types of minerals, but for uranium, and especially on Navajo, the issue is it mining and extraction of uranium mine waste when about 80% of the uranium mine waste is still there, while about 20% of the high-grade uranium is transported off the reservation for commercial sale or, you know, milling and processing at Energy Fuels uranium mill in Utah. So there's many questions. There's questions about how this process has been sold to different commissions on Navajo, in particular Eastern Navajo Land Commission. They are not providing accurate information, along with Navajo Nation Environmental Protection Agency. Navajo EPA has a responsibility to honor the Community Right to Know Act, which is not being honored, and that's federal law. They are not having full disclosure, even of the details on who's going to be making the capital gains on the selling of this uranium once it's supposedly going to be processed.
Let's roll this back a little because I think it would help if we understand what this HEPSA or high pressure slurry ablation system does. It injects water into the mining waste, creating a slurry, yeah,
Worry.
mixture. And from there, they extract leftover uranium that's still capable of being used in nuclear reactors for fuel or nuclear weapons. And that then becomes a product that
Yes.
DISA can sell, can transport and sell. Whereas what it is leaving behind is the leftover slurry, which has more radioactive uranium waste in it that's not capable of being used as a product. And that is, again, left on Navajo Nation land as a contaminant. Would that be an accurate assessment?
Yes. Even the question of where they're going to get the water to do this ablation, you have to have millions of gallons of water. The other issue is they don't know what type of machine they have to construct. There's no machine yet. There's only like a small, like a commercial washing machine type dishwasher that they used under a small 8x10 canopy. So that pilot project was out here, but it wasn't to scale. So when they do it to scale, they're going to have to bring in diesel or gas generators to run the machine that's going to do the ablation process. So cost effectiveness is not nowhere near. How is this going to be really effective? And I really assume that once a scenario happens, of course there's always accidents, miscalculations in the process. Why are we going to have to bring in diesel gas operating generators? It's just causing more harm to the people. And it's not for the people, this project. It's for the company. Because now they have a license to operate in 14 states, which have been contaminated. So it's a money-making scheme.
And of course, water is one of the things that's most precious in Navajo Nation because you have so little of it.
Yes, exactly.
Now, you mentioned licensing. DISA has sought federal licensing to proceed, and the Nuclear Rubber Stamp Commission, excuse me, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, issued a draft environmental assessment and a finding of no significant impact, which is referred to as a FONSI. They did this last August 2025. How can the NRC justify saying there would be no significant impact by using this process?
Well, it's a generic findings of no significant impact. And there's really been no push from the local communities because they've been left out of this process. The communities have a right to know.
There have been no hearings, no opportunity for community input to it.
No, not even by Navajo EPA, who is the sole responsible party to let the people know, community right to know.
And who has been granting permission from Navajo Nation for this company to come in? Is that completely the NRC? Or is there some Navajo-based entity that said, yeah, sure, come on down?
Well, it would have to be Navajo EPA and also the Navajo Resources Community Development Committee would also have some type of authority But it seems that this project is just being rushed because of the Trump administration. And just remember that the phase two project, the funds are not going to Navajo. $3 million are going to the company.
They already have the money.
No, it's the project. Phase two, the project proposal has been submitted January 15th, 2026. So that's pending. But when they get that, if they do get the project funded, they're still going to have to do 90-day public hearings because they're going to have to do a site-specific environmental impact statement. They can't just do environmental assessments. I've worked for Navajo EPA for 4 years in the past, so I understand how they're maneuvering and not letting the people part of this conversation because the questions are going to come up. And because they have no answers, because they're saying it's a study, they don't know. And so it's just too much risk for the Navajo people to carry that burden again. And the company will have no liability if there's something that goes wrong, if there's an accident, if workers get sick. The company is not liable. The Navajo Nation will be.
So, in other words, if this goes through, they get the profit, you get the radioactive garbage and all of the negative side effects and the cost for all the negative side effects.
Yeah, but Navajo EPA, Stephen at City is saying, well, I have statutory authority in CERCLA that I can promote this project because it's going to reduce the radiation contamination by 20%. But in reality, you got to look at the whole picture, the whole scenario, not just choose and pick what statutory authority that they're going to be honoring. There's also, like I mentioned, the Community Right to Know Act. So public hearings are inevitable for this. We just want to stop the project so we don't have to waste our people's time. The resources that Navajo EPA is putting into this project is unbelievable. It's like, why can't the federal agency also move projects like this on our water systems? It's inequitable. Inequitable for our people when the government and Navajo EPA are catering to outside foreign companies. It's a conflict of interest, especially for Navajo Environmental Protection Agency is a regulatory agency. They shouldn't be going into businesses with outside foreign companies. Just bottom line. And then Tetra Tech, also, some of the folks in that company were found guilty of fraud in decreasing radioactivity levels on some of their studies. So they were found guilty. So we really want to know who is going to be part of this project. Are they going to be like felons again? So it's a big picture that only one part of the scenario is being shared with the public. But our people have a right to know the entire scheme of this project.
You just mentioned a company called Tetra Tech. What is their place in all of this?
They were funded by Navajo EPA, and they, in their study, said it's commercial extraction process designed to produce marketable uranium. It's not comprehensive cleanup solution. That's what it says in their study. But we are being told differently. And there's a misclassification of extraction versus cleanup. Remember, it's remediation of a limited amount of containment. There's really no such thing as cleanup. So it's commercial profits, which is extraction versus remediation. It's being called now uranium is a critical mineral for corporate sale. So it fails to meet cleanup standards because the processed material, 83% of it still remains on the site as radioactive. So cause no harm is one of the bases of public health. In doing this project is causing more harm and posing more risk of health issues, maternal health issues. The safety of people on the Bureau of Indian Affairs, very dangerous roads. You know, transporting the waste is not an option. This project is not an option for Navajo people. And our leadership with Eastern Navajo Land Commission, Navajo EPA, they're not listening to the people. The people are the governing body. The people have the last inherited right to defend our land and to demand honesty and transparency to our people. And one thing is, we're not going to be intimidated. We're not going to bow down to how different genders of men, Navajo men, treat Navajo women. Because as Kia'ani, I am Kia'ani clan, we have every right to say what we feel, and we will not be intimidated by anyone.
It seems from an outside perspective that the pressure point needs to be with Navajo EPA, because they're the ones who are interacting with the federal government on it.
Exactly. Yes.
So what input do the people of Navajo Nation, such as yourself, actually have to influence what Navajo Nation EPA does?
Well, February 14th, we are scheduled to do a public information webinar at the Eastern Navajo Agency Council special meeting. So we'll be presenting to 31 chapters, and we hope that they do get a quorum, because this is a very political issue, but we're doing this in a public health realm. And also our Community Right to Know Act. We just want to know the truth.
And will you have any power to influence or sway Navajo Nation EPA, which sounds like they've already made up their mind? I'm sorry, I'll be cynical about this.
Yeah, they made up their mind, but we also have our legislative oversight, the Resources Community Development Committee.
And they can put a stop to this, or they can slow down?
Yes, and we also have the Budget and Finance Committee to go before, because the liability issues are huge. So there's a lot of unknowns, and on behalf of the Navajo people, we are calling these entities out to be fair and honest to our people and stop making excuses that this is a done deal and whatever we're doing to oppose it is mute. It is not mute.
Is there anything that those of us who are not members of Navajo Nation but are concerned about the issue can do to support you?
I think letters to the editor. We want to get a petition opposing this. The more petitions there are, the better. Because with our nuclear resistors around the world, locally, statewide, and nationally, this issue impacts them as well. Because this uranium may be going for more nuclear energy or for more nuclear weapons. So the whole nuclear resistance family have every right to ask the Navajo Nation to stop this project. Because it's not only us, it's the other 14 states, other indigenous lands, other communities that have no political say or don't have economic well-being, that don't, you know, they don't have the voice. So we want to stop it at the root, and that's on Navajo. We are still being looked at as a guinea pig for this project.
And if this project gets established in Navajo Nation land, you're saying that there are 14 other locations with abandoned mines and indigenous people where the same scheme will be attempted?
Yes, exactly. And a lot of this is not only for the nuclear industry, but for the data centers. This critical mineral is for fueling a lot of the data centers. There's 5,000 data centers being planned in the United States. And so a strong movement around the country is happening. And some have been successful in stopping the data centers from encroaching on their communities, because water is the main issue here. Water access, you know, it's got to be the people over profits. Here too on Navajo, people before profits. That's what we want to say loud and clear. This is not the 1920s anymore. We got to stop feeding the corporations and start feeding our people.
You and so many others have been fighting for a genuine cleanup, or at least as far as cleanup can go, remediation, and against further contamination of your lands for decades now. What do you do to keep going with this? How do you keep yourself in full heart and moving forward?
I listened to John Trudell. John Trudell was one of our teachers at the Aim for Freedom Survival School in Oakland. So the past few days, I've been listening, because when I moved back home, that's what saved me in the 80s, and that's what's saving me now, especially the honor song. You got to hear that. John Trudell is one of my strong inspirations, and his voice rings more true of his vision of what he had decades ago. And of course, with my family, with the ceremonies we have, and how we hold close our corn pollen and the true power of what we have as a people.
My own experience of you is as a powerful, indomitable, fierce, loving, kind and gentle, but still fierce woman. And it's good to know that you have all of that supporting you, and that gets imbued into the work that you do on behalf of your people and planet Earth and all the rest of us.
Yes. And I'm thankful you were in our Hogan praying with us too, LeBay.
It was an honor to be asked to do so. We're going to, of course, stay in touch with you and continue to follow this issue as it goes through whatever the steps are to come. For now, Anna Rondon, I want to thank you for all of the incredible work that you have been doing, and for once again being my guest here on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Yeah, thank you. In beauty it shall be.
Anna Rondon, veteran activist on behalf of the people of the Navajo Nation. We'll provide links up to their recent webinar on the cleanup con job and the New Mexico Social Justice Equity Institute on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 762. We'll also have a link up to one of the inspiring recordings that Anna uses to bolster her spirits, one by the late John Trudell, a Santee Dakota activist, poet, musician, and actor. We'll be back with this week's second featured interview in just a moment, but first, it is not a good time for those of us advocating for sanity when it comes to nuclear weapons and reactors. The last remaining arms control treaty with Russia, New START, expires this Thursday, February 5th, only 2 days from now, with not a twitch of interest from the United States in extending it. The Trump administration has also secretly overhauled a set of nuclear safety directives and shared them with the companies it is charged with regulating without making the new rules available to the public. And as for radiation exposure limits, it is recommending increasing the public exposure standard 5 times to 500 millirems annually, with no stated concern or consideration of what that would mean to the health of people exposed to it. And at every step, informing the public and allowing us our say in this process has been thwarted. What can be done to turn this trajectory of madness around? That's what we address on this program, and that's why you need Nuclear Hot Seat. Every week, we bring you a range of stories, interviews, and special features that allow you to understand what's going on in the nuclear world and what you can do about it. We, the people, are not powerless, and that includes our concerns regarding the future of all things nuclear. But to act effectively requires honest information, and one of the few places you can trust to find it is here every week on Nuclear Hot Seat. But we can't do this job without your help. Nuclear Hot Seat runs on donations, and without them, the show cannot continue. That's why the time would be right now to support us with a donation of any size. And we make it easy. Go to nuclearhotseat.com and look for the red donate button. If you have Zelle, you can send money directly to info at nuclearhotseat.com, and with Zelle, no fees are taken out. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that anything you donate is tax deductible. Any amount helps, so don't wait. Go now to nuclearhotseat.com to donate. And know that whatever you can do to help, I am deeply grateful that you are listening and that you care. Now, here's this week's second featured interview. Kevin Camps is the radioactive waste watchdog with Beyond Nuclear and our go-to source on a wide range of radioactive waste issues. 2 weeks ago on Nuclear Hot Seat number 760, he spoke about the proposed Holtec high-level radioactive waste dump and the disappointing ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court. Here, he brings us up to date on the problems with Holtec's planned restart of the shuttered Palisades nuclear reactor in southern Michigan, on the shores of Lake Michigan. We spoke with Kevin Camps on January 16, 2026. Kevin Camps, once again, we are honored to have you on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thanks for having me.
The Palisades zombie reactor, as you refer to it, in Michigan, is currently scheduled to be brought back online, or at least that's the industry's intent. What is the background on Palisades and where do we stand with it now?
Palisades is a 60-year-old reactor. It was designed in the mid-1960s. Ground was broken in 1967. It fired up in 1971. It was a lemon from the get-go. It had more than 50 years of problem-plagued operations. We dodged many radioactive bullets in southwestern Michigan on the shoreline of Lake Michigan. Not everybody did. There are thyroid cancer rates in the immediate neighborhood south of Palisades that are off the charts. So not everybody's dodged bullets at Palisades in the past half century. But now Holtec, which got a hold of Palisades promising to decommission it, but immediately reversed itself in secret, wants to restart Palisades. So since June of 2022, when most people thought Palisades was permanently closed, Palisades, Holtec, has been scheming with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to restart it. So we are 4 years into this nuclear nightmare of an unprecedented atomic reactor restart. And yes, I call it a zombification. And unfortunately, this precedent, which is poised to be culminated soon, they were claiming for years they would restart in 2025. The month would retreat from June to December. They didn't make that deadline. Now they're saying February, March 2026. We'll see if they make this deadline. The way they've done this, they've had to make it up out of thin air how to restart a permanently closed reactor. It's a Rube Goldberg machine of regulations patched together because there are no rules about this. So they patched it together. Holtec proposed a pathway. NRC said, yes, of course, sounds great. We've been on this roller coaster ride for 4 years. We've been through the NRC licensing proceedings at the so-called Atomic Safety and Licensing Board. Everything we brought up over the course of years has been rejected. We've appealed everything to the NRC commissioners themselves. They have not ruled on a single one of our appeals. So they've got a logjam of appeals sitting on their desk, and they're going to push a go button at some point. When Holtec says we're good to go, the NRC commissioners will reject all our appeals and bless everything that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission staff, the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board, Holtec have done. And then they can restart. And they're very close. A part of the reason they didn't make their end of 2025 deadline is they've had some real serious problems in recent months out there. The one that's gotten the most attention is steam generator tubes that are severely degraded, a self-inflicted wound by Holtec, which neglected maintenance for the first 2 years that it had Palisades. So the steam generator tubes were already problematic. They should have been replaced 20 years ago. They made the situation much worse. So that is a risk pathway to meltdown. Holtec has merely slapped Band-Aids on this problem. They have not fixed the problem. And our expert witness, Arne Gunderson, has a high level of confidence, unfortunately, that at least one tube will either leak or burst, which will release hazardous ionizing radioactivity into the environment. The bigger risk being that the one tube will cascade into a multiple tube failure. And if you fail enough tubes all at once, that is a pathway to reactor core meltdown. So we could have a Chernobyl or Fukushima on the shoreline of Lake Michigan.
And wasn't that tube difficulty with the steam generators actually what shut down San Onofre in Southern California?
Exactly. And Arnie Gunderson played a big role in that shutdown, serving as an expert witness for Friends of the Earth. So we're very fortunate to have him on our team. He has been completely ignored by the NRC, the staff, the licensing board, even the Advisory Committee on Reactor Safeguards have completely ignored everything that Arnie has raised. And they've also ignored another nuclear engineer whose name is Alan Blind. He's retired, but he was a senior engineer at Palisades for the better part of a decade. He also served a similar role at Indian Point in New York. You combine their expertise, their experience, it's more than a century of relevant experience. They've both been disregarded, and they've raised dire warnings about the steam generator tubes. This is just one safety issue of many at Palisades. It's the one where there was an opening because Holtec screwed up so badly that we were able to get in there a little bit, but the door has been slammed in our face yet again. We have filed our first lawsuit in federal court in Western Michigan. We hope to be heard soon. It's regarding the exemption request by Holtec to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to reverse the permanent shutdown certification filed by the previous owner, Entergy, in 2022. And it's a very long document. It simply reverses all the paperwork. And again, they made this up out of thin air. And there are Supreme Court precedents from recent years, like West Virginia versus EPA, and also Loper-Bright, which say that federal agencies cannot just make stuff up. They need congressional authorization to do what they do. NRC does not have this. They've simply made it up. They are beyond their authority. So we'll see how this lawsuit goes. But as soon as the NRC commissioners reject all our appeals about things like the steam generators, our intervention on the inadequacy of the environmental reviews, the list goes on and on. As soon as the NRC does the wrong thing, makes a final record of decision, we can then take those appeals to the federal courts. We hope to do so. We're going to fight this thing to the bitter end because there's too much at stake. They are going to play radioactive Russian roulette on the shore of Lake Michigan as soon as they fire up. And we just can't sit idly by and let them do this. We may lose, but at least we'll have done what we can and shined as much of a light on this as possible. We haven't even talked about Holtec's scheme to build two new reactors on the same site. They call them SMR-300s, so-called small modular reactors, but 300 megawatts electric each, so that ain't small. It's actually, just to cite some infamous reactors in Michigan, Big Rock Point, which is Palisades' sibling, 250 miles north, was a 67 megawatt electric reactor. So these SMR-300s are 4.5 times bigger. Holtec wants to build one at Big Rock Point too, but the first ones will be at Palisades. So Big Rock Point, a small reactor, relatively speaking, released more than 3 million curies during its 35 years of operation. That's an underestimate because they didn't even keep track or documents or records for the first years, which would have been the worst years back in the early 60s. That's one of the worst records in the country on radioactivity releases from a tiny reactor because they were experimenting with different fuels. They had mixed oxide, plutonium fuel, rods break and release their contents in the core during full power operations. Again, thyroid pathology up there, spina bifida, statistically significant spina bifida has been identified near Big Rock Point, tiny reactor. Another tiny reactor, infamous though, deservedly so, Fermi Unit 1 in Monroe County, Southeast Michigan, 67 megawatts. These SMR-300s are 4.5 times bigger. Fermi Unit 1 had a partial core meltdown on October 5th, 1966. And John Fuller wrote the iconic book, We Almost Lost Detroit, that came out in 1975. Gil Scott-Heron had a song by the same name, We Almost Lost Detroit. These are much smaller reactors than what Holtec wants to build on the Palisades site. So now you're going to have three reactors on a tiny 432-acre site, cheek to jowl. You could have domino effect meltdowns like happened at Fukushima Daiichi. And in fact, you have both extreme ends of the risk spectrum. You have the breakdown phase risks at the 60-year-old zombie reactor, and you have break-in phase risks at the two brand-new SMR-300s. And just to give folks some idea of what break-in phase risks can lead to, Chernobyl Unit 4 was a brand-new reactor, less than a year old. Three Mile Island Unit 2 was a brand-new reactor, less than a year old. Chernobyl and Three Mile Island Unit 2 are some of the worst disasters in human history. It's the worst reactor disaster in U.S. history, although Santa Susana is a pretty bad one too. And it's been said that Fukushima may overtake Chernobyl in terms of consequences at some point. Don't take that from me. Take it from Yablokov, who was Yeltsin's environmental advisor. He said it at the National Press Club in D.C. on the 25th anniversary of Chernobyl, a previously organized press conference that just happened to take place 6 weeks after Fukushima had begun. So Yablokov used his time at the National Press Club to point out that Chernobyl is bad. Yes, it is. He's one of the experts in the world on that. Fukushima could surpass it because of the population density of Japan, the direct releases into the Pacific Ocean. It just may take time to get there. So we're risking such catastrophes on the shoreline of the Great Lakes with Holtec schemes at Palisades.
Kevin, this work is so taxing, so frustrating, so relentless. I need to ask a personal question. How do you keep going?
Well, I've got some tremendous colleagues who lift me up. Also, the stakes, you just can't. I mean, Lake Michigan was sacred to me before I knew anything about nuclear power or nuclear weapons. And ironically enough, that new movie, House of Dynamite, spoiler alert, I mean, Chicago's what's being targeted by a nuclear missile. And there was one line in it. Can't we just divert the missile into Lake Michigan? Or might it miss its target of Chicago and land in Lake Michigan? And I'm sitting there and I'm like, that's not okay. You know, so I'm inspired to try to protect the Great Lakes because I've had the honor and privilege and joy of calling them home my whole life, except for my political exile in Washington, D.C. to fight these issues, but often on behalf of the Great Lakes. So I don't know. It's tough, though, because we're in a very dark place right now in all kinds of ways, with Trump in the White House, but it very much applies to the nuclear power issue. As your listeners know, they are gutting radiation protection regulations in terms of health. They're gutting safety regulations at the NRC. They're rubber stamping new reactor licenses left and right. So I guess we just got to keep fighting the same fight we've been fighting forever. It's just more intense right now. And of course, I do hope that this house of cards falls down, but let it not be a Chernobyl scale catastrophe at a place like Palisades. That's why we're trying to prevent the restart, prevent the new builds. And of course, it happens to be what I'm working on. It's a microcosm of what's happening across the country and around the world, even just with Holtec. Holtec wants Palisades to serve as the model for it to deploy SMR-300s nationwide and worldwide. Holtec wants to build 20 SMR-300s in Ukraine. They announced that a couple years ago. So a part of our inspiration to fighting the Palisades new builds is we would really love to stop that from happening in Ukraine and any number of other states in the U.S. and countries around the world, where just this one company, Holtec, has visions of building literally scores of these things in the not too distant future.
And to be clear, SMR, small modular reactors, or small modular nuclear reactors, such as Holtec is promoting, they do not exist. There has not been a model built and tested.
Exactly. And that's, you know, when you've got bugs in these new designs that aren't new designs, they're scaled down versions of old designs. But yeah, they're tweaking the designs to get away with it all. You're introducing the potential for unforeseen problems that present themselves the hard way, like at Three Mile Island Unit 2 in 1979. An unforeseen design flaw, mechanical failure, operator inexperience. That is break-in phase risks at atomic reactors.
I'm glad you're on the front lines, Kevin, because I don't know that we could have anyone better there. I'm also sorry that you have to be on the front lines, that there hasn't been a resolution to any of this yet, and we have to keep going. Because of that, I'm grateful for the number of times you've come on this show to explain the issues and for once again being my guest on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Always a pleasure. Thanks.
Kevin Camps, Radioactive Waste Watchdog at Beyond Nuclear. You can follow him at beyondnuclear.org.
Activists, shout out.
Our shout out this week is a story about activists who stood their ground, taken out of our shared nuclear past. This particular story is still active in our present. And here to tell us all about it is Jack Cohen, co-coordinator of the Nuclear Resistor.
Imagine you're a lab tech on the night shift, keeping an eye on important gauges and dials. After a time, you realize that these instruments you monitor at the government lab are vital parts of a secret nuclear bomb factory. What to do? Mordecai Vanunu wasn't sure, but in 1985, the Moroccan Jewish immigrant to Israel brought his camera to work and snapped a few dozen photos of the telltale technology he operated. Unsure where to turn with the evidence that would soon shatter Israel's notorious nuclear ambiguity, Vanunu left his job at the Dimona Nuclear Research Facility and hit the road with the incriminating film in his backpack. Months later, in Australia, he found community at an Anglican church and was baptized as a Christian. At a church study group on nuclear disarmament, Vanunu shared his story about Israel's bomb. A freelance journalist there told Vanunu his photos were worth a lot of money and shopped the hot story around. Soon, Vanunu was in England, secretly, or so he thought, sharing his story with a crack investigative reporting team at the London Sunday Times. But when his bombshell finally hit the newsstands in October 1986, Vanunu was missing. Anticipating a bounty, the disreputable reporter had also peddled Vanunu's story to Israeli agents, who then trailed the would-be whistleblower to London. Essentially alone in the big city, Vanunu waited nervously in a hotel while his story was fact-checked by nuclear experts. Israeli agents were still on his trail, ready to exploit the young man's vulnerability. A female Mossad spy, masquerading as an American tourist, befriended Vanunu as he walked the streets of London. It was a classic honey trap. Cindy, she called herself, lured him to Rome, promising respite from the unfolding drama. When they entered an apartment there, Vanunu was immediately assaulted by agents in waiting, forcibly drugged, bound in chains, and spirited across the Mediterranean for a secret trial in Israel. Global media was fast on the lookout for the man who blew the whistle on Israel's secret nuclear arsenal. Weeks later, Vanunu's fate was confirmed when photographers captured images of the prisoner leaving court. He'd pressed his palm against the van window, and on it he'd written the words, "Hijacked in Rome, 30 September 86," and written his flight number. At his secret trial, Vanunu was found guilty of treason and espionage and served his full 18-year prison sentence, the first 11 years in solitary confinement. The Nuclear Resistor worked closely with the U.S. campaign to free Mordecai Vanunu. We collected petition signatures, solicited support from public figures, sponsored plays and speakers, lobbied Congress, and organized protests and civil disobedience actions at Israel's embassy in Washington and many of its consulates in the U.S., all spotlighting Israel's nuclear arsenal and demanding freedom for the imprisoned whistleblower. In 1997, American peace activists Nick and Mary Eloff legally adopted Mordecai Vanunu, joining the few people allowed to visit him in prison in Israel. My wife, Felice, worked with U.S. campaign coordinator Sam Day Jr. and allied campaigns in Israel and other countries to organize an international conference about Vanunu in Israel, as well as international delegations protesting there for his release. In 1998, Felice and Sam took part with others in a citizen weapons inspection action at Dimona and were hauled off to a nearby jail. When Sam died in January 2001, Felice became the coordinator of the U.S. campaign. And she was in Israel with over 100 international supporters in April 2004 to greet Mordechai Vanunu when he finally walked out of Ashkelon prison. Right-wing Israelis taunted them, shouting, "Kill Vanunu," while throwing rocks and eggs as police cleared the way for the car that carried the peace hero to his initial refuge at St. George's Anglican Church in Jerusalem. Joyous as the day was, release from prison did not mean that Mordechai Vanunu was truly free. Severe restrictions on his freedom of movement and association were imposed in the days leading up to his release. These constraints have been renewed each year since, now for more years than he was in prison. His internet use is closely monitored. Vanunu is forbidden to leave Israel or to speak without prior approval to foreigners or the media. Since 2004, he's been arrested on several occasions and spent a few more months in jail for violating these limits. Vanunu's message is unchanged. He is proud of what he did 40 years ago, confirming for the world that Israel has a nuclear arsenal. He has no more secrets to tell and wants nothing more than to be able to leave Israel and live in another country. This has been Jack Cohen Joppa for Nuclear Hot Seat, with a story of conscience and personal sacrifice for a nuclear-free future from the archives of The Nuclear Resistor.
Jack Cohen Joppa of The Nuclear Resistor. If you haven't already done so, I encourage you to sign up for their newsletter by going to nukeresistor.org. In closing, this has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, January 13, 2026. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, it's the easiest way to make certain you never miss a single episode. You can sign up for that email by going to your favorite podcast channel, or cut to the chase and help us out. Go to nuclearhotseat.com, look for the yellow opt-in box, put in your first name and email address, and every week, you will get one email with a link to that week's show as soon as it posts and a short description of its content. Now, you're on the ground in your area, and if there's a nuclear issue, you know more about it than I do. So let me know. If you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, thank you. Any amount helps us out, and we really appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2026, Libby Halevi and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you, ignoring the impact of nuclear radiation on our lives and health doesn't change scientific facts of what harm it is doing. It just keeps us trapped in the dangers. There you have it, your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.